This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton has a new memoir that was published this week and became an immediate bestseller. It's called Living History. And as you probably know by now, she writes about her childhood, her marriage to Bill Clinton, and her life as First Lady and Senator from New York. The book also covers some of the territory she had previously kept off limits surrounding the Monica Lewinsky scandal. I recorded an interview with Senator Clinton yesterday. Senator Clinton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
When your husband was the president, he was attacked by what you described as the vast right-wing conspiracy. He was impeached by the House. He was investigated by the special prosecutor. Many spectators emerged from all of that disgusted with politics. But you entered politics after this, running for Senate. Why did you want to get deeper into politics after everything that you saw happen to your husband?
I think that's obviously a really good question, and I thought about it a lot because many of my friends and close colleagues urged me, you know, not to run for office, not to even put my foot into this environment, which was so toxic, and the politics of personal destruction were the unfortunate consequence of the very partisan battles that were being waged. But I took a very hard look at what I thought was happening below the surface, that these very difficult conflicts over the direction of the country were ones that bothered me greatly, because I knew that despite the mistakes I made and certainly acknowledge in this book and the problems that my husband and I had, which are part of history, unfortunately, there was something else at work. And what was at work were two competing visions of where our country should go. And I believe that it's worth fighting for those values that I grew up with, that I thought America represented, and that I thought that my husband and I at least tried to further and stand for. So it was not an easy decision. But after I'd been through the gauntlet and been accused of everything you can imagine and really come out of it still standing, I thought, you know, if I walk away, if I say, you know, I don't want to be involved in politics, then I'm really actually conceding a victory to those whom I oppose so strongly. And I guess finally, I would say that, you know, one thing that always bothered me during the time in the White House and still to this day is that it really does matter what the political decisions are in terms of how the rules of the game are set and whether everybody in this country feels that he or she has a fair shot and a chance to, you know, live out that American dream. And I see the odds increasingly stacked against the average American. You know, we hear about huge tax cuts. We hear about environmental regulations rolled back. We hear about all of the issues that families and people talk to me about. But what is not covered as well, what is not understood, is that there's a very concerted effort with a right-wing agenda to turn the clock back on America. And the administration in Washington today is one of the most radical and reactionary, albeit with, you know, a lot of nice rhetoric that we've ever had in American history.
Senator Clinton, you were a kind of symbol of evil for the right when you were the First Lady. But I think that you are being less demonized now that you're actually in office as a senator from New York. Do you agree that you are more demonized as First Lady than as senator? And if so, why do you think that that's true?
Well, I think that it really is rooted in, I'm sure some people symbolically being bothered or worried about what I represented apart from who I am as a person. And I also concede that, you know, obviously I'm not everyone's cup of tea. You know, I'm very outspoken. I work for what I believe in. I stand up to people in ways that I think
But you're
help
trying to
make
do that
point.
As a senator, not just as a First Lady. What's the difference in how you perceive?
Well, but I think, you know, the First Lady role is such a unique symbolic role, and it stands for so many things that the woman herself has, you know, only passing reference to. It is a generational symbol, a historic symbol, a concept of womanhood, of all of that rolled up into one person, which is why it's always been a rather challenging role for me and my predecessors, and we've each tried to do the best we can in our own ways. But now I've got a real job. It's a job that comes with responsibilities and obligations to the people I represent. I get up every day and try to figure out how I'm going to improve life for New Yorkers. I work with my colleagues on both sides of the aisle because there are coalitions that I can help to form around issues that I think matter to New York and America. So it's me acting on my own, less symbolically than substantively. People can agree or disagree with the votes I cast or the speeches I make on the Senate floor, but I'm not carrying this enormous weight of expectations that you never can meet, and that certainly become even more of a flashpoint when you have a president who is breaking down barriers and trying to move the country in a progressive direction.
Do you think do you think it's also that your job as senator doesn't depend on your marriage to Bill Clinton? It's not about the marriage. It's not about him. It's about you.
Oh, I think that's a big part of it. You know, first ladies are kept at a distance, and they are part of this enormous apparatus around a president. After all, the only reason I or anybody was in the White House during Bill Clinton's administration is because he in some way selected us to get married, but everyone else invited to work in the White House. So the president is the overwhelming figure of importance. There isn't any staff person or first lady or anyone else who can claim anything but derivative authority from the president. Well, senators get to speak for themselves and their constituents. And that was one of the transitions that I had to make from a political helpmate, a first lady, to a senator, speaking on my own, speaking on behalf of my constituents. But the final point about that, Terry, which I know it's difficult to really articulate, at least for me, because it's kind of in the realm of history and symbolism and myth almost, is that when you're in one of these roles that are really, as I say in the book, a kind of Rorschach test for other people's marriages, for their aspirations, for their views on politics, for their economic hopes and dreams. I mean, it's all rolled up into quite a complex jumble, and there's no way, at least from my perspective, to totally unpack it. I think we can't separate out that what Bill and I stood for politically was at the root of the extreme partisanship and opposition. You know, they could have just said, look, you know, she's a baby boomer generation first lady. We don't like her. But that wasn't the nature of the attacks. It was, look what they're trying to do to health care. Look, they're trying to take your guns away. Look what they're trying to do to the environment. Look at this. Look at that. And so it became, the personal became the political. And it's very hard when I, even to this day, see fundraising letters sent out about, stop me, stop me. You know, it's not just me as a person. It's the political point of view, it's the values, it's the vision of America I have that they consider so threatening.
Now, your opponents on the right were very skilled at attacking your husband's presidency, attacking your health care campaign, attacking your marriage and your private life. The Democrats now are having a very hard time in forcefully opposing President Bush and his policies. Particularly the tax cut, this unprecedentedly large tax cut at a time of war with Iraq, facing, you know, the expenses of war, facing the expenses of the occupation. Democrats who are critical of how the Democrats are handling President Bush now say that the Democrats aren't being forceful enough in their opposition. I mean, critics are saying the Democrats are just afraid to really stand up. They want to be perceived as centrist in the hope that that will help them win the next round of elections. What do you say to those critics who think that the Democrats just aren't doing a good enough job right now?
Well, I understand a lot of the frustration, and I would say several things, as I do to friends and constituents who raise this issue with me. There's a very big bully pulpit in the White House. I know that probably as well as anyone because I was there for 8 years watching it in action. So we close ranks. We support our president. Elections are times to, you know, really decide whether we want someone to continue or not. And certainly in the atmosphere in which we find ourselves after September 11th, that is even more true. And I understand that and accept it. Secondly, I think there is a fundamental difference, which I came to perceive during the 8 years in the White House, which I do talk about in the book, and that is that, you know, Democrats really traditionally are more into the business of governing for the betterment of people that they believe we represent, so that it really matters to us, you know, what the details are when you argue about the Medicare prescription drug benefit, or when you worry about whether the clock's going to be rolled back on environmental regulations. And I have really come to see how the Republicans are so much more adept at and understanding of power, and therefore their take on most political conflict is, what do we have to do to win? Now, you can say from a perspective at some distance, well, gee, you know, that's a gross generalization, no pun on your name, Terry, but, you know, that's a very broad, sweeping statement. And of course it is, and it's not true in every case. But in general, I think there is some real truth to it. And therefore, it is harder often for Democrats to explain where they stand. Are you for or against a tax cut? Well, you know, we're against unreasonable, unaffordable, irresponsible tax cuts, but we would like tax cuts that help the middle class, that target investment, that create jobs, etc. Whereas, you know, that message takes a lot longer to say than, we're for tax cuts, end of sentence. Whatever they are, as big as they are, we're for them. There's another element to this, though, and I think that I, again, have firsthand experience with it. The Republican Party, the conservative wing of the Republican Party, has literally been on a mission for probably 40 years to turn the clock back on things that they disapprove of, whether it was, you know, going back to the Great Depression and the creation of Social Security, or in the 40s, the expansion of unions and worker rights, or in the 50s and 60s, you know, the government intervening in civil rights. You just pick a subject where there's been sweeping change, I believe, on balance, for the better for America. There has been a hard core of right-wing conservative Republicans that have built their influence day after day, and I give them credit for this. I mean, I think it is a tremendous accomplishment that they have taken what used to be in the extremes in our political philosophy and moved it into acceptable territory. And they, of course, were disappointed, which now has been written about widely, when Barry Goldwater was so badly beaten, but it didn't stop them. They came together. They endowed professorships. They started think tanks. They began to really work to make their worldview the American mainstream worldview. So when Bill Clinton was elected, that was an abrupt interruption in their entitlement to power. For the last 24 years, there'd only been one Democratic president's term, and that was Jimmy Carter for 4 years. And from talking with people who are quite proud of their accomplishments in changing the political landscape in America, they viewed my husband as a tremendous threat, not just because he won the presidency, but that he did actually speak for the majority of Americans who wanted fiscal responsibility combined with safety nets and combined with investments and combined with opportunities for people to be more responsible for themselves and also for our country, to have a different face in the world, more leading from our values and our leadership qualities as opposed to just our military strength, which is obviously unmatched.
Where do you see the Bush administration, and President Bush in particular, in terms of what you described during your husband's presidency as the vast right-wing conspiracy? Do you see anyone in the Bush administration, including the president himself, as fitting into that group or as furthering that style of politics?
Absolutely. And, of course, in the book I say that the word conspiracy was probably not a very accurate description, because there's nothing secret any longer about this. You know, they're not meeting in you know, behind closed doors. You know, they do things in secret, like the so-called Arkansas Project and the like. But by and large, this is a very open agenda that is well-financed and well-organized. And I think this administration, with the people who are in it, whose views on both foreign policy issues and domestic issues are so extreme and radical, are very much the ultimate victory in some respects for those who have been speaking out against school desegregation and public education and a woman's right to choose and protecting the environment against the ravages of unchecked development and pollution. And you go down the line, and I think that the great untold story of this administration, which the media is certainly not paying attention to, is how what used to be considered so radical has been put into a new suit of clothes with a very nice smile and nice words like compassion. But I don't think that this administration in reality is either compassionate or conservative. I think it is hard-edged, radical, right-wing, with a very specific view of where they want to take America.
Do you ever look at some of the people who are or have been your political opponents and who criticized you or your husband for personal reasons, for your way of life, for your stand on women's issues, for his affairs or whatever, and look at them and think, you're a hypocrite. I know something about your personal life that isn't public. Do you ever think thoughts like that? And would you ever want to see somebody's personal life exposed if you thought they were being a hypocrite?
Well, no, I really don't. I think we should draw a line there. But in the book, I write about a few of these people, and you know, I say that I certainly can sympathize with their outrage at having their public problems aired in the light of day, but it was stunning to me the double standard they were operating under. But you see, from their perspective, they are on the side of all that is right and good and important and significant, and that's a political judgment they make, that, you know, the ends do justify the means if you're taking away a woman's right to choose. The ends are okay if the ultimate objective is to eventually, over time, dismantle the Medicaid program because you're going to block grant it and cut the resources that are going to guarantee health care for children and people in nursing homes. And those kinds of issues are really their primary focus. So they excuse an enormous amount of personal issues on their side of the ledger, which they do on a daily basis. I'm very well aware of that, because they're all part of this overall mission to take back America. You know, there's this group called the Federalist Society, which has been around for a while and which vets every single judicial nominee for the Bush administration. If you're not okayed by the Federalist Society with their very conservative, non-mainstream judicial philosophy, you don't get nominated by this White House. And so the result is we have people being nominated who are incredible in the values and the attitudes that they bring to the bench. But this Federalist Society has for years now talked about bringing the Constitution back from exile. Now, when did the Constitution, in their view, go into exile? It went into exile when the Supreme Court under Earl Warren rendered the decision in Brown v. Board of Education. Now, I happen to think that was one of the most significant points in American history, not just judicial history, but every bit of our history, because it moved us one step closer toward tearing down the walls of segregation and trying to create a truly integrated society, as difficult as that is. But these are people who really do want to turn the clock back. I used to think that they were interested only in turning the clock back on the Clinton administration, but honest to goodness, they're on their way to trying to undo Franklin Roosevelt, and I think they're going to, you know, be closing in on Teddy Roosevelt pretty soon.
Senator, I know that you think that your husband's affair with Monica Lewinsky was very personally damaging to your marriage and not a good thing to do, but you didn't think it was an impeachable offense. Do you think that presidents should be judged at all on that aspect of their private lives?
Well, Terry, you know, I had this rather unique experience of working on the impeachment staff in 1974 when Richard Nixon was impeached. I was just fresh out of law school, a young lawyer. I worked with Republican and Democratic lawyers, members of the committee who were so careful and literally nonpartisan. It wasn't just bipartisan. They knew that this was an awesome undertaking. And one of my tasks was to research the legal and historical precedent behind the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors, which appears in the Constitution when it talks about impeachment. And I have no doubt that it was not personal matters that our founders and those who were making the decisions about our Constitution had in mind. They were focused on those kinds of actions and behaviors that would affect the public performance. In fact, you know, there was a big debate.
But should it be judged at all by individuals? How do you think?
Of course, anything is going to affect how individuals feel about another individual, whether that person's, you know, in the White House or in any other walk of life. But when you see the political process being perverted and the Constitution subverted for partisan purposes in what was an unprecedented attempt to grab power away from a lawfully elected president using his personal failings, which he's admitted, which were horrible for my family and which just caused me incredible pain and distress, but to use that for a partisan political purpose was very dangerous to our system of government and to our Constitution. Now, luckily, the American people got it right, as they often do. They saw through it. They understood what this was about, and in huge numbers stood behind the president. And despite the fact that the House Republicans had the votes to go ahead and impeach him, you know, that didn't in any way affect the senators, who didn't even give a majority vote to any of these charges.
Because
thankfully, it worked out. But look what it put the country through. I find that, just even now reflecting back, hard to understand.
Because the president risked so much personally and politically by having the affair with Monica Lewinsky, and because there's been speculation about other affairs, there's been a lot of people who have thought that he must have some kind of sexual addiction or compulsion. Do you think that he does?
Oh, Terry, I think I've gone as far as I would go in my book, which is a whole lot farther than I ever thought I would in terms of talking about, you know, very private personal matters. And I have to say that many people in interviews over the last several days have said, well, you know, you're supposed to be such a private person. Why did you even write about this? And of course, I wished it hadn't been made public. I wished our situation could have stayed within our family in the counseling that we did have, but it wasn't. It was forced into the public by people who could have cared less about me or my daughter or my mother or Bill's family or anything else. It was for a malicious purpose, and I am just going to let my book speak for itself.
What crossed your mind when you heard from the new Robert Dallek biography of JFK that JFK actually had an affair with an intern?
You know, I guess maybe I read enough history growing up and have been involved in politics for long enough to know that we don't have any saints in public office. We don't have any perfect human beings. The performance of a president and his leadership on behalf of our country is really for Americans themselves to judge and for history to judge. I think my husband will be judged very favorably by history, because I think he did a good job for our country. I think when he left office, we were well prepared for the future. And as to other presidents, I think the same standard should apply. There are, you know, many people who, it's human nature, I understand that, want to know what happened behind closed doors, who did what to whom. I don't think there's any direct correlation between a president's private behavior and his public leadership. So I think we'll just leave that for the historians to sort out.
I know you're on a very tight schedule, so I'll just ask you one more question. You've worked with Tom DeLay and Lindsey Graham on legislation. And, I mean, these are people who really opposed her husband during the impeachment era. Is working with them an exercise for you in swallowing poison, or an exercise in just like finding the common ground?
It's an exercise in doing my job. It's an exercise in building coalitions and consensus around issues that I think are important and that matter to the people I represent. And I also really do believe that there is more than ample ground on which we can disagree and be absolutely adamant in what we think is right for the country politically. But I don't think that we want to continue the politics of personal destruction. I'm frankly more concerned right now with what I see as the politics of economic destruction being propagated by the administration and the Republican Party. I'm going to take them on that issue. I don't have any need to try to undermine them personally, try to demonize them. I'm going to take Tom DeLay on over the child care tax credit, which he is adamantly opposed, which we passed to remedy a grave injustice in the Senate last week, and I'll take any of my other colleagues on when it comes to important issues. But when we can find common ground, you know, maybe I can try to demonstrate that that's the more appropriate way for us to engage in our political differences, by working together whenever we can and by standing strongly but not personally, destructively against one another when we have serious differences.
Senator Clinton, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, I enjoyed it. I hope we'll get a chance to talk again sometime.
Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, her new memoir is called Living History.